Hey listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue is the end-to-end solution for insight, outreach, and analytics for higher ed advancement and stewardship teams around the world. Recently, we launched Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub, where subscribers have access to over 100 hours of free, on-demand original series and podcasts, all created with fundraisers in mind. We're thrilled to feature the development debrief on Evertrue Studios podcast network. Check us out at evertrue.com/studios.
Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising.
Hello, and welcome to season 13. This season is different because half of the 8 episodes are going to be focused on artificial intelligence. However, there are a few episodes sprinkled between that aren't focused on AI, including today's. While understanding AI is important, we also need the EQ that occurs in between skilling up. And one of those huge skills is navigating difficult conversations. As Jennifer says, contact and context before content. I love that phrase. This episode is the pep talk you perhaps didn't even know you needed. Jennifer empowers us to tackle our challenges head on, eliminate negative self-talk, and take care of ourselves throughout the process. We go through 3 real-life examples, and Jennifer talks through how she would handle them. These examples were actually submitted by real-life listeners just like you with their real-life challenges. Let's learn more about Jennifer. Jennifer Zaslow is an executive coach who believes that harnessing your full potential begins with finding your voice. She began her professional life in New York as an aspiring opera singer, an experience that led to a 20-year career as a leader and senior fundraiser in the nonprofit sector. Today, as partner at ClearPath Executive Coaching, Jennifer's signature mix of intuition, directness, and humor enables her to work successfully with clients ranging from CEOs to young leaders, helping individuals to reach their full potential and organizations to achieve their strategic goals. Jennifer has worked with leaders and teams from a wide variety of sectors, including higher ed, at Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Cornell, and University of Pennsylvania, arts and culture, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the New York Public Library, the Metropolitan Opera, New York City Ballet, BAM, the High Line, sports, media, and entertainment with the NFL, Sundance Institute, BuzzFeed, KCRW, and tech startups, Google, Chief, and TodayTix. Prior to coaching, Jennifer held the Chief Development Officer role at 3 New York City cultural institutions: Manhattan Theater Club, the New York City Opera, and the New York Public Library. There, she successfully completed a $500 million capital campaign during the 2008 recession and grew the library's endowment to over $1 billion. Jennifer holds a BA cum laude from Wesleyan University and a CPCC coaching certification from CTI. She's certified in the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, is a Gallup-Clifton Strengths Coach, and is a recipient of Harvard Law School's PON Certificate in Mediation and Conflict Resolution. She is also director of the Florey Alasky Institute for Arts Leadership, sponsored by the Jerome Robbins Foundation. She lives and practices in New York City. Now let's get started. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to The Debrief.
Thanks, Catherine. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, today's topic is working through challenging conversations, which is universal no matter where you are in your career, what kind of institution you work for. We are going to be having challenging conversations no matter what. And yet somehow, so many of us don't know how to do it. With the fundraising background, we are often told to listen and that's really just not enough. Where do you begin, Jennifer?
Yeah. If the advice you're getting is just listen, that's really only scratching the surface. But listening is important, and most of us don't know how to listen. And you can tell me if maybe later in the show notes, you're going to share tools, or you want me to demonstrate some tools. Listening is something we really need to learn how to do. And I would say in a difficult conversation, listening can often be more important than talking, but it's only the beginning. If we're actually trying to get to a new place, to a resolution, to a detente, to a new understanding, we actually need to know how to engage in a conversation where you say something, I say something, you say something, I say something. So it is certainly more than listening. In my coach training, I was taught a tool, an acronym called WAIT. Why am I talking? So, and I think for fundraisers, this can be kind of just something good to remember. We're expected to talk. We're expected to understand our mission and speak about it in order to fundraise. But sometimes we need to step off of that and make space for someone else.
Yeah. You've talked, though, about the importance of the interplay. And so many times I've been told that the perfect response is to say, I'm going to find out and I'll get back to you. I mean, I've been told that from the very beginning of working as a fundraiser. So how do we thread that needle of engaging? Because I completely agree with you. We have to be able to engage in a conversation about current issues or whatever it is that they're troubled with, but then also not speak out of turn, because I think that's what people are afraid of, is saying the wrong thing.
So I'd make a distinction between a conversation that's about information, which is what I would call a typical conversation, and the other kind of conversation, which I think is the topic of what we're talking about today. And I would call that a crucial conversation. And that comes out of a book called Crucial Conversations by Kerry Patterson and Joseph Grenny. It's a kind of a seminal work that, you know, we can talk more about. What is a crucial conversation? A crucial conversation is one where emotions run high, where there may be a difference of opinion, as opposed to, can you tell me about this program? And the fundraiser doesn't know the answer and wisely says, yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll get back to you, which is, I would call that a typical conversation.
What a good distinction.
Yeah, I mean, we need to understand what we're talking about here. There has been a lot of thought and even research put into how to navigate a crucial conversation, a difficult conversation. And I think the context for the discussion we're having today is that we recognize we're in a world where people are really not doing a good job navigating the nuance and complexities of these kinds of conversations. We're very polarized. People are very dug in to their own perspective. And the reason, going all the way back to your question about listening, the reason listening is so important is because you don't care how much I know until you know how much I care. For me to express caring for you and create a space in which you feel safe, in which you feel cared for, I need to know how to listen to you. I'm hesitating because my inclination is to just talk about a listening tool for a minute. Should I do that?
Please do that. And before you do, though, I also just want to make sure that I say, we are navigating this with donors externally, but then we also need to be navigating it with colleagues and stakeholders internally. So
yeah,
I'm hoping this tool will work for both.
Yeah, it works for everything. It works for your spouse too. I mean, it is worth saying out loud that, you know, we think so much about how to manage our stakeholders, meaning our external stakeholders like board members and donors, and it never occurs to us to apply the same generosity or benefit of the doubt or even collegiality with our own colleagues as we do to our external stakeholders. So yeah, this is meant to be for everybody. So three levels of listening. It's a coaching listening tool. Level one is called internal listening. This is when basically what we hear when we're in a challenging conversation is the sound of our own voice in our heads. Wow, Catherine, I'm thinking while I'm talking to you, I wish we'd had this conversation later in the day after I'd had breakfast. I'm so hungry, I'm probably going to screw it all up, etc. This is the voice I hear in my own head, usually when I'm under stress. I think most of us can relate to what this is like.
I certainly can.
Yes. We sometimes find ourselves in a conversation with someone. We hear the sound of our own voice in our head, and we come back to the conversation and realize that we missed 60 seconds of what someone said. It like poof, disappeared. That's level one listening. Level two is called focused listening. This is where I have a laser sharp focus on the content of what you're saying. I'm keeping a very narrow channel between me and you. I'm listening hard. Maybe you're my boss giving me a project, but I'm really listening for content and keeping my focus on that. That's level two, focused listening. Finally, level three, which is where you want to be in a crucial conversation, is global listening. This is where you widen the aperture of level two. You widen your focus. So you're taking in not only the content, but all kinds of other data that we as humans are capable of taking in. Context, subtext, body language, even on Zoom, although it's harder. Really understanding meaning beyond words. That when we're communicating with each other as life forces, as energy forces, everything communicates, not just the words we're saying. So we're listening beyond the words to really try to understand what's going on with this person. Maybe we're even in a room in a team meeting and we're taking in the body language and responses of other people around the table. What does this enable us to do? Well, one, we may learn things beyond the words that people say. And in fact, sometimes the words people say mean exactly the opposite of what they're trying to communicate. And beyond that, by taking in all this additional data, we may be able to be sufficiently nimble to use that data in real time. Catherine, I hear what you're saying, but I almost wonder if you mean X, Y, Z. Could that be, or are you trying to communicate something more than that? Or Catherine, I noticed that as you're speaking, people are shifting in their seats in the room, and I'm wondering if they're not understanding what you're saying. And I wonder if we could just take a pause and have you back up and re-explain that so that we get to a deeper level of meaning in the conversation. So that's level three listening. Level one, internal listening. Level two, focused listening. Level three, global listening. That's the listening you want to try to inhabit in a crucial conversation. I see you nodding.
Yes. Are there ways that we can green light, like easy things that we can show people, whether they know it or not, consciously or unconsciously, that we're global listening? Like, is there a certain type of body language or... You know, nodding is one thing to show, but are there other things that we could bring with us to meetings and visits?
You know, my inclination is not to prescribe that. Rather, I would say this. As I was talking, I observed your eye contact with me. I observed you nodding. I think when we're present, and that's really what global listening is, it's about being present. When we're curious, and I would say curiosity and presence are inextricably linked. So when you tell yourself, if your mantra was get curious, you will all of a sudden become present.
Yeah, okay.
What is it like to be like a child exploring your environment for the first time? I think that you're asking me, how can I show that I'm listening? Well, I think you will show it by being present. Of course, you can nod your head. Of course, you can reflect back what you're hearing. So what I'm hearing from you is, I guess I'm just not a fan of being too prescriptive about that because I'm not trying to turn everyone into a pod. I think the physical manifestation of your listening will be authentic if you're really there. And that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And you can't fake that.
No, I think you can't. And I think that's what in a way gets to the heart of what we're really talking about. We're really talking about communicating on an animal level. We are humans, we are energy forces, and we are animals. And I think we can sniff these kinds of relationships, the kind of dynamic, the energy force that passes between people, again, even on Zoom. That what we're really trying to do is make a connection with people before we even get to the topic of the conversation. Contact and context before content.
I found that too as a manager, that sometimes I'll skip over the how are you and go right into the agenda. And when I do that, it's a different meeting as opposed to how are you today? How has your morning been so far? And it just somehow gets more attention or more connection for the conversation than you would if you didn't stop and do that. It's so important.
And I would ask you, what do you observe that does?
I think it disarms people. It helps them to realize that you're not just focused on the work, but you care about who they are as a person. And so much of what we do is impacted by the context of what's happening around us, either in our personal or professional lives.
Yeah. What does it do for you in the conversation to ask that question and have it be answered?
It gives me data to know what I'm working with.
Yeah, I get that.
I reached out to a handful of my listeners and asked them if they had anything they were struggling with right now that I could bring to this episode. And I have three examples. So I was thinking it could be fun to read you those and get your feedback because it's so much more interesting in context.
Love it. Yes, love it.
Okay, so I'll start with number one. I've been promoted and am now managing people who are my peers. I'm already noticed them telling or asking me for things like more remote time or setting up meetings with my boss. How do I gain back my influence and authority in this new position?
First of all, I noticed that the person who framed the issue didn't frame it as clearly as it might have been framed. And that gives me a clue about how this person communicates. So, because I think part of what we need to do in crucial conversations is be clear. And I have a tool for that too. It's called radical candor. If we can't be clear with people about the behavior we're seeing that doesn't work for us, how will they know? Okay, so the question on the table is, do I ignore this as a new boss? Do I just let it slide? No, in coaching, we do something called designing the alliance, which is when we first begin work with a client, we talk about not just the what of what they wish to be working on, but the how of how we will work together as coach and client. This person, who we'll call Joanne, is now leading her peers. In addition to talking about the what of what they're all working on together, she needs to redesign the alliance. She needs to talk with them about the how of how they'll be working together. What are her expectations about the how? Some managers might be fine with their reports having skip step communication with the VP, if that's how it works. But there is a redesign needed. And how might those conversations happen? Well, I would say they're probably one-on-one. I think there needs to be an explicit framework, like let's redesign our alliance.
I love this that term.
This is a real situation. We were colleagues. Now I'm your supervisor. Let's name what has changed. Let's name what won't change. I respect your opinion. I respect your work. And of course, each conversation will be different based on the relationship. This is a big step for me. I'm going to need your help and support in order to be successful. What obstacles do you see, she might ask, in our working together? What do you need from me to be able to work together constructively? What kinds of communication will you need with the VP, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. You make it sound so easy.
What do you think is not easy about it?
Well, it's funny because you cut through the noise in a way that makes me feel more relaxed.
Ah.
There is so much, as you mentioned earlier, the internal voice that is swirling around with something like this. We're talking about interpersonal relationships, potentially ego. There's a lot of stuff, and you're basically just saying, name it and discuss it. And it seems like that should be the, of course, obvious first thought, but it wasn't mine when I read this.
So let's pause for a commercial message on self-awareness and self-management. To be a leader, we need not only to have mastered certain substantive hard skills. This person has been promoted as a fundraiser because of her talents and expertise and experience. The challenge for all of us is that probably she has not had any training in what it means to manage a team and be a leader, which is really bananas if you think about it, right? That we're promoted to these jobs that have higher impact on our teams, impact on the results, impact on the donors, and we get zero training on how to do this piece of our job. Marshall Goldsmith, a very famous coach, wrote a book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. Which he means all the talents and skills that got you to be a senior director not only may not be particularly useful when you get to associate VP or VP, they may actually be working against you, that you're going to need to seek out and accrue a whole new set of skills to be successful in those higher roles. So now let's go back to the commercial message about self-awareness and self-management. Because part of your new training to be a successful leader is that you have to improve your self-awareness, which means you have to know yourself. So what I hear, something is not being said. What was not being said is Joanne's fear that she may not be able to successfully manage colleagues who once were her peers, that they won't respect her, and that she may wind up being delegitimized. And she fears that. How can we address those internal feelings of insecurity, delegitimization, and basically going back to the animal, fear? Just basic fight or flight. It's the same physiological response. When we have the anxiety of insecurity, we go into fight or flight. So there are a couple tools. One, I'm a big fan of meditation and mindfulness. We're talking about a physiological response to stress. where our heart pounds, we start sweating, we get tunnel vision. This is what happens to us if we're running from a saber-toothed tiger. The difference is those physiological responses, while they served us in getting away from the predator, actually undermine us when we're in an office trying to run a team and fundraise. Activating something called your parasympathetic nervous system, if you've ever done yoga, and basically breathing. Breathing. Let's do it right now, Catherine. We're going to take a big, deep breath in through the nose and a long exhale, longer than your inhale, out through the mouth.
That was the longest exhale I've had in a while.
The long exhale is key. That's what activates your parasympathetic nervous system. It calms everything down in your body. You can't think your way out of that kind of stress. You actually need a practice, a body practice, a somatic practice. How do you feel after that long exhale?
Definitely more relaxed, a little more open.
So that's tool one. Let me give a second tool. I think we all struggle with the inner critic. Do you know what I mean by that?
Like negative self-talk?
Yes, exactly. Negative self-talk. You're nodding. Do you know what that's like?
Oh yeah, I wake up and fall asleep to it.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Could I put you on the spot for a second?
Sure.
When you have a little negative self-talk, what do you hear?
Just, and nothing is quite enough. You know, you should have done that 5 minutes earlier. You should have thought of that yesterday. You should have preempted this thing. You should have known this was going to come. And it's, you know, I've done some work with recognizing it and seeing what it is. And I've been able to quiet it a little bit, but I don't know that it will ever fully go away. It's ingrained in my brain.
Yeah. So thank you for being open to sharing that. I think we can all really relate to that. That's what I call the saboteur. And that term comes out of a framework and a book called Positive Intelligence by Shehzad Shamin. There are a lot of resources out there to help us work on the inner critic. But if there is one thing that your listeners come away with today, working on the impact of the inner critic, I think, is the most impactful thing we can be doing for ourselves. Because going back to Joanne, she can have these crucial conversations with her people. That's the external work. Mm-hmm. And I think redesigning the alliance with her team and talking constructively about how they'll be working together is key. Equally or even more important is the internal work she may need to do on that inner critic that may be saying to her, "You don't deserve this job. Who thought you could do this? You're never going to be able to lead your colleagues. Who are you kidding?" Which basically is something any of us would feel in that uncomfortable situation. And it's worth noting, when I asked you, what does your inner critic sound like? I heard you say, "You didn't do enough," or "You should have done it faster." I'm curious, Catherine, how often, like in a week, are you saying to your colleagues or team members, "You didn't do enough, you should have done that faster"?
I would never. I would never talk to my colleagues the way I talk to myself.
Okay, so bingo. That's how we know, that's a clue that it's a saboteur.
That's a great way to identify it. Like, yeah, would I say this to someone else? That's great. Let's move on to scenario number two. So we're starting with an internal one. I love all of the angles that we covered. The second case was sent in on the Instagram at Dev Debrief, for those of you who listen who might not be following. And the scenario is a new dean that came along with a tumultuous administration, and after only a few years, we're again in the midst of a dean search. While it's not uncommon for donors to want to wait to give until they know who the new leader is, this donor's underlying concern that the school lacks direction and a vision won't be appeased with a new leadership announcement. It's ultimately what's holding him back from committing to a multi-year major gift to the school. What do I do?
I heard a lot in that scenario. And it kind of made me think, just zooming out for a second. Do you know the term VUCA?
No.
It's an acronym that was coined by the American military kind of during the Cold War, and it stands for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous.
Whoa.
It's been adopted, largely adopted by the corporate world. I don't hear it much in nonprofit, but I mean, it's so fascinating to me because it's truer today post-COVID than it ever has been.
Yes.
The environment in which we're working, especially in higher ed right at this very moment, is VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And I've been thinking a lot about how that maps to the very ancient and Buddhist principle of impermanence. That everything is impermanent, everything changes. Everything is changing all the time. If you look up to the sky, you will see the clouds passing over. Nothing freezes for a moment. We are in constant change. Okay, so bringing us back down to earth, this person, Steve, is in a scenario where there have been recent leadership changes and they're about to have another leadership change. Always hard. This is the impermanence. This is the VUCA. And the thing is, the sooner we get used to the fact that this is not going to stop, there's not going to be a time where there are no more leadership changes. There is not going to be a time where everything kind of freezes and we can just do our work in an environment where we know all the variables.
Right.
So sorry, again, this comes back to self-management. One of my favorite quotes is by Jon Kabat-Zinn. We can't stop the waves, but we can learn to surf. And I think that's what we're talking about here. The waves in this scenario are the constant change.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve needs to learn how to surf them. So what does he do? Okay, he's got a donor who is reluctant to make a gift because there's been a leadership change. And even with the announcement of the new leader, they may not make the gift anyway. So, I mean, what are the choices? We're talking about challenging conversations. It sure sounds like Steve would like to have a conversation. Yeah,
the
go ahead.
The question I have about this scenario for Steve is, was this donor ever going to do it? Because I find that sometimes donors can use that kind of change as an excuse, maybe. How do we determine whether or not this is an excuse or this is real? And what do they need to have to get there if it is real? That's my question.
Okay. So this, I agree with you, first of all. And I think let's make a distinction between what we can control, what we can't control,
mm-hmm.
and what we can influence. It's kind of like a Venn diagram. You know, if you think about that, in the middle of what we can and can't control is a thinner area of what we can influence. So the question on the table for Steve is, can I influence this person? And if so, how? Well, this is where crucial conversations come in. What does that conversation sound like? It may sound like, First of all, naming what you see. Mr. Donor, I know you were really demoralized by our last leader leaving. So was I. It was really hard. The university has done a lot of work to try to identify a leader who will create stability here in an unstable world. I certainly can't guarantee that that's what will happen. But I'm not even sure that's what's holding you back. And I think what I would love to talk with you about today, if you're willing, is what do you want to see at this university? If I could hand you a magic wand and you could wave it and create the scenario that you want to see or the program you want to see, what would you describe? Maybe we could work backwards from thinking about it like that.
Now that's going to invite a whole nother conversation. I love it. Really yeah. Gets part of it.
So say more.
Because it's taking away what we, the external, you know, what we can't control factors, and taking it back to the donor and the donor's passions. And often what I've found in my experience, when donors would say something like that, like, you know, I'm not going to do this because I don't like X, those are the ones that care the most. So this person really cares, but does Steve know what they care about?
Well, how could we possibly know unless we ask them?
Mm-hmm.
We are constantly at war with ourselves around trying to look like the experts we are expected to be. So in the face of a donor who cares but is dissatisfied, we may feel like we need to twist ourselves into pretzels to guess or suggest or come up with the magical solution that will change this donor's opinion. And I think that is it may be kind of a waste of time, and it's kind of looking at the situation backwards.
Yeah, it's the opposite.
Exactly. What would it be like instead to let go of being an expert, cultivate that not knowing mind, which in Buddhism is called child's mind, get curious, enter level 3 listening, and ask a simple question?
We went through 2 really good scenarios, and we have a third. Are you ready to hear it?
I'm ready. I'm ready, Catherine.
So I'm starting to sense a theme here. I think I know what you might say for the first reaction here. My university feels like it's having a complete identity crisis. Sometimes we hear too much from leadership, and others it's radio silence. How do I talk to my boss about feeling unsupported as a representative of the university? Who am I to ask for money when I don't agree with leadership choices being made?
Well, I would say there are 2 questions being asked there. One is, how do I talk to my boss, which is a crucial conversation. And the second is, how can I, I'm existing in a values misaligned environment in right. which I'm being asked to represent my university when I don't agree with its direction. And that is beyond the realm, I think, of difficult conversation. So let's just put that over here and talk about, how do I talk to my boss? So if this person were here, and I'll call her Susan, if Susan were here, I would ask her, what's the obstacle to speaking with your boss? theoretically, we have relationships with our leaders that enable us to have these kinds of conversations. So yes, we can speak about techniques for having the conversation. And also, let's ask ourselves, does our environment welcome, encourage, support these kinds of dialogues? And if not, I think, Susan, you'll have to be a pioneer. And so what does that sound like? Catherine, let's you and I model it, okay? So I'm going to be Susan, and you're going to be my boss. You have the hard part. Hi, VP of Development. I'm here. You know, thanks for taking the time. I emailed you to ask if I could have a conversation with you about how I'm navigating the complexity, the ambiguity of our environment right now, how I communicate to donors. Sometimes I have information, sometimes I have no information. How should I be handling this?
Well, you don't have anything that I don't. You know, I've just given you whatever I've been told, but we're all of our hands are tied here. We don't know what's going on.
So that's a great answer, because I think this is me stepping out of the role play, because I think I'm curious, is that an answer you would typically get?
That's what I imagine this person is getting. And I think I think the frustration is at all levels.
Yeah.
But I did the kind of sort of the non-supportive boss, but I could be the supportive boss. I don't know which one.
Be the boss you want to be. Okay. Be the boss you recognize her. Sorry. from the distant past. I'm going to respond now. You know, I really hear that. I first of all, I appreciate your telling me that you don't know anything more than I do. So that's fair. So then I'm going to reframe the question. What do we do? How do we together handle the not knowing? How do we handle not understanding where we stand and still communicate with confidence to donors? And I'm betting that this probably pertains not just to you and me, but to the entire team. So what can we be doing together to create an environment of support? And before you answer, let me say, I recognize that it probably is not about getting more information, because the information may not be available. But what about the how? Not the what, but the how. How do we handle it? Because we still have to talk to donors. We can't hide our heads in the sand. So how do we talk to donors when we don't have information?
I hear you, and I'm glad you're telling me that this is coming up in your conversations. And unfortunately, like you said, I'm not going to be able to give you more information right now. But we can't stop doing our work, and perhaps we just really lead with honesty in saying that we are in a transition right now, and this institution existed long before us and hopefully will exist long after us. What we're asking you to do is to trust and invest. That feels weak.
You were shrugging your shoulders even as you were saying it. Yeah.
That's a tough one.
I think what's coming up here is that this is hard.
Yeah.
It's hard for all of us. I'm going to take a crack at it. Let's reverse roles.
Right.
I really hear what you're saying, Catherine. And let's start with, I'm going to spitball here and think about how I would talk to a donor in this moment. So, and I'm thinking about a donor I have who's, you know, considering a $10 million gift, and we're in limbo right now. So I might say something like, We're short on information, but we're long on commitment. And, you know, I can't sit in front of you here and give you all the answers about where we're headed. So I kind of was thinking, let's shift the conversation a little bit. I've been at this university for 10 years. I've watched it grow. I've watched it weather challenges. I've watched students arrive on campus, spend 4 years and graduate different people. I watched my own son graduate from university. You know, I look at us navigating what is possibly the most complex political situation of anything I've seen since, honestly, the 1960s. And once again, we are at the center of the universe. Academic institutions are a home for ideological debate. And I gotta say, in some ways, this is the hardest moment for me. And in other ways, I have never been more energized. And I think really all I can do in my conversations with you and other longtime donors like you is that we're in this fight together. We're in a fight to defend debate. We're in a fight to educate people. I'm going to stop here. But you see where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea if any of this is effective. And also, I would say maybe it focused too much on me.
I liked the human side of it. I liked the little bit of personal you did share. I thought that really humanized it.
I think all I'm getting at here in this scenario is that it takes some creativity.
Yeah.
It takes some shape shifting. It takes some leaning into your humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes naming what is right in front of us both. I mean, I think, you know, you and I had a version of a conversation about how fundraisers don't always get treated with the respect they deserve.
Yes.
That there can be, trying to say this respectfully, a kind of distaste attached to our focus on raising dollars for our institutions, that there's an underbelly of that that seems dirty, and we're dirty along with it, which is very painful, I think, for a lot of us.
Yeah.
We tend to be highly educated. We tend to, you know, be subject matter experts. In some cases, we can speak more concisely and cogently than the actual subject matter experts who might be teaching the course on this.
Right.
And yet we don't always get the respect we deserve. And I think part of that is because we're trying so hard to be polite in a lot of the conversations we have, to the point of being sycophantic. And that doesn't feel comfortable for any of us. And I would really just suggest, let's drop that and get real and see what happens. I think we need to find a way to communicate that honors our self-respect, our intelligence, our education, and our complex understanding of global events and our ability to navigate difficult conversations with nuance. We can do this. I think we uniquely can do it as fundraisers. And ditto for our donors. They tend to be highly educated, sophisticated people capable of real dialogue. So let's have it. Let's model these conversations for them, the kinds of conversations we would like to be seeing had on campus that are respectful while not shying away from the difficulty, nuance of the gray.
I think people are craving that, really.
I agree.
I think what that requires is, again, the inner work of knowing what do you stand for, what's important to you, and infusing that into the conversation, not as the primary, like you said, but as one piece of it. And when people, it's just tough though, because when people say, well, what do you think? What do you think? And if you don't agree with what the institution is saying or choosing, it goes back to the heart of this comment, then you can get yourself a little bit stuck.
So this is where I think navigating the gray comes into play.
Yeah.
So my institution, for instance, may have shut down some student groups who wish to speak, and I don't happen to agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Things happen all the time. Our leaders make decisions that we may not agree with. And part of the pact, I think, that we make with our, if we choose to be a representative of an institution, we choose to go along with its decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, the institution creates a climate in which we can voice our opinion and even dissent. But when decisions are made, our job is to get behind them. And we always have the choice to choose a different institution if this institution does not align with our values. So we're never prisoners. We are at will. And I think, you know, this also speaks to Pat Lencioni's Five Dysfunctions of a Team, where he talks about, and not to get into the depth of a whole other model, but the importance of constructive disagreement and making a distinction between constructive disagreement and commitment, which is once we have had the real conversation and maybe even disagreed, a decision gets made, and then we all need to get behind it,
mm-hmm.
because that's how companies and organizations move forward. We cannot move forward if we don't get behind the decisions that are made. And so going back to the discussion, you might say, I might say, you know, in the privacy of the back room, I actually dissented on this decision. I didn't happen to agree with it. But the university is bigger than me and has visibility into impacts and decisions I may not see. And so when an organization makes a decision, it's my job as VP of fundraising to get behind it. That's why I'm here. I'm an actual fully realized human separate from this university. As you may be able to ascertain, I'm a real carbon-based life form. Here I am. But I'm here on behalf of the university. I think, you know, these are not insurmountable challenges. They require an ability to communicate with nuance. And this takes practice.
Mm-hmm.
When I say that to you, Catherine, how does it land? How does it come across?
It makes me trust you more because I am getting an honest response, but then you're also asking me to potentially recommit with you as well, which is comforting in a way. So I think our industry is, well, I know our industry is really lucky to have you because you've done the fundraising work and now you've really developed this incredible expertise around coaching. Are these the kinds of conversations that you're having with your clients?
Constantly, constantly. How to navigate these conversations is one of the, I would say, one of the key things we're talking about. And I would say the way we modeled some of the conversations today is what I think works the best.
Yes.
We can talk about concepts and resources. We could talk about VUCA and crucial conversations and listening tools and all that. But I think your listeners need to see it in action and actually practice it. You need to figure out what are the words you're going to get out of your mouth.
Yes.
What feels authentic to you, what feels comfortable, and you probably are actually going to have to practice it.
I'm a huge fan of that as well with ask conversations and other hard conversations. So I'm glad that you use that model. It can feel a little bit funny at first to be pretending to be in that conversation, but the more you do it, the more you get used to it. And I totally agree. So thank you for giving us a taste of what it would be like to work with you, and a couple really good book recommendations as well.
Great.
I'd love to close with my signature question, which is, what do you know for sure?
I can tell you that I had kind of an epiphany when I left fundraising and I started being a coach, that really my biggest enemy as a coach was certainty. Hmm. And that was a real paradigm shift. As fundraisers, as professionals, we're expected to be experts. We're expected to speak with authority, with certainty in our field. And I was really tired of that.
Mm-hmm.
In coaching, my stance, any coach's stance, is curiosity, which is in a way the opposite of certainty.
Yeah.
In a world where everything changes, I have no illusions that I could know, that I could know things for sure. And instead, I'd much rather ask questions.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing a lot of great tips and ideas for us to chew on.
Thanks, Catherine. It was really great.